From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Andrea Seabrook. Television fans, start your big screens. Striking Hollywood writers are considering a contract proposal. After nearly 15 weeks on the picket line, members of the Writers Guild of America received contract terms from their union leaders at meetings this weekend in New York and Los Angeles. Salim Akil, who worked on the sitcom Girlfriends, is one of more than 10,000 members of the guild. He went to the Los Angeles meeting, and he says the strike has been worth it.
I think what people probably want to see when everyone comes out here is cheering masses. But you're going to win some, you're going to lose some, and in any negotiation, you're going to compromise. And that's what you're going to see coming out of here. I think happy people who know that there was a compromise but feel good enough about what happened that they can move on with their lives and not feel bitter.
The writer's strike has put thousands of other entertainment business employees out of work and has stalled production on scripted TV shows. NPR's Kim Masters has been reporting on the strike, and she joins us now. Kim, did the writers get what they wanted?
Not exactly. The writers are very much in a cup half full situation. They did make some advances in terms of getting increased payments for their work in certain areas. They got some jurisdiction over work that's created for new media, the internet. They got some payment for streaming, you know, media streamed over the internet. But they did not get certain things that they very much wanted.
Like?
Well, one of the key sticking points in this was that question of advertiser-supported streaming video. So if you want to see The Office and you go to an NBC website and you play The Office, the writers wanted to be paid for that. They wanted a percentage of the money that the studio would get from the advertising. Mm-hmm. Now, it looks on the surface like they got that, but in reality, if you really read the fine print, they're getting a fixed payment and it's not a particularly big one. So I don't even think the writers necessarily know this yet. They did not receive the terms of this contract until just hours before these big meetings that were held last night. And they are only going to have a short time to look at and digest and figure this out. And when they do, you know, I think they'll very much see the cup is half full. And when it comes to getting paid for those streaming videos, for example, they'll feel that they don't even have a foot in the door. They basically sort of have a little toe in the door. But there's a lot of pent-up desire for these people to go back to work. They've been on strike. Many of them have given up thousands and thousands of dollars in opportunities and lost their contracts. And so, you know, I think they're going to accept it.
Kim, so your guess is the rank and file will go for the deal?
Absolutely. I mean, apparently last night at the meeting in Los Angeles, which was the bigger one, there was a lot of cheering and applauding and relief that it's over. And as I said, I don't think they necessarily know what the fine print says, but there's a point where you sort of declare victory. And I think they're looking down the road to a negotiation that might happen next time. They have at least some language in there about getting a percentage of the money from these streaming videos, for example, even if they don't really get a percentage of the money. Mm-hmm. So next time they're going to try and make that language into a reality.
Okay. So the Writers Guild story may be over, but then the Screen Actors Guild, their contracts come up in June.
Yes, there's a lot of anxiety in the industry still. The Screen Actors have made it really clear that they want to sweeten the deal. They're not just going to take what the writers got. So we're all waiting to see what the Screen Actors are going to say. The studios, certainly when it comes to movies, they're planning to try to hurry some stuff into production so that they can finish those movies in the event of a Screen Actors strike at the end of June. They want to be finished.
Okay, but most important question, Kim, when will the TV shows get back on the air? I want my Office fix.
I think we're all fixated. And the good news is I think The Office is one of those that will be back quickly, because the less complicated they are and the more successful they are, the more likely they are to be back fairly quickly. The Office would be on that list. Those scripted hours might take just a wee bit longer.
NPR's Kim Masters, thanks very much.
Thank you.
This weekend, the National Portrait Gallery in Washington, D.C. is opening an exhibition that may seem surprising for a venue where visitors expect to see, as one curator put it, pictures of white men on horses. Instead, on the first floor, there are photos and portraits of hip-hop performers and a wall of graffiti. The show is called Recognize, Hip-Hop and Contemporary Portraiture, and it's intended to show the influence of hip-hop and rap on visual arts today. NPR's Allison Keyes reports it also raises some questions.
You'd expect a hip-hop exhibition to have a soundtrack like this joint from Public Enemy.
I testified, my mama cried, black people died when the other man lied. See the TV.
Instead, almost all you'll hear is this.
You are not just bored or hungry or silly or just crying for attention.
The museum commissioned spoken word artist and activist Nikki Giovanni to write an ode to hip-hop for the exhibition. Visitors will hear her reading it.
You are just, if there is a just, trying to be an artist. You are just, if there is any justice, trying to find a way of not just surviving, but living.
Giovanni's poem is juxtaposed with an installation by Brooklyn artist Shanique Smith. It's a striking mixed-media calligraphy column that climbs the wall. It combines images from magazines, clothes, spray paint, and pictures of artists. Curator Frank Goodyear says the two pieces together create a portrait of hip-hop.
She's created this piece that's called No Thief to Blame that incorporates almost a dozen different portraits of hip-hop's stars, interestingly, all of whom are now deceased, in a kind of altar-like space. And if you sit here, you kind of get a sense that this altar almost acts like a wave that comes kind of crashing over you.
I'm like a little kid looking at that thing with the painting and the spoken word and the real dope artist. It was just mind-blowing. I didn't even know anything like that exists.
D, from the legendary rap group Run DMC, is not featured in the exhibition, but he doesn't care. He visited the Portrait Gallery's website and says the show is a real representation of the art and culture of hip-hop.
Hopefully, this will inspire people to look at hip-hop in a bigger way, and also in a better way, because, I mean, the whole thing about hip-hop was it's the total expression of the world that we live in, and it shows it.
Two 20-foot-long, 4.5-foot-tall graffiti murals cover one of the museum's classical ivory hallways. The artwork, by local D.C. artists Tim Conlon and Dave Hupp, throbs with color. Curator Jobel Boone says this is a way to let visitors see that portraiture isn't just pictures of dead presidents.
It's a wonderful opportunity for us to use graffiti as a new form of portraiture, a way to make the public think outside the box, that portraiture doesn't have to be a representation of a person's face or their body.
But of course, sometimes it is, though not in ways you might expect. The exhibition includes several works by Kehinde Wiley, including a kingly portrait of actor-rapper Ice-T. The performer is sitting on a sumptuous robe, holding two scepters in a work inspired by 19th-century painter Jean-Dominique Ancq's vision of Napoleon on his imperial throne.
When I say, oh, I'm working on this hip-hop project, everyone usually steps back. It's hip-hop.
David Sheinbaum contributed black-and-white portraits of some of the hundreds of hip-hop artists he's photographed in performance since 1999. He says his art world peers don't get the culture or the music, and he didn't either at first. Then he went to a concert by Del the Funky Homo Sapien with his son.
I think I was somewhat a victim to media stuff, you know, everything I had read about it was negative, basically, and I wasn't seeing that, and that was what motivated me to photograph.
Sheinbaum listens to the music as he prints the photos. One of them is of Nas on stage, mic crushed against his chest as he leans to the side. There are two fingers in the bottom of the frame, reaching out from the audience.
If this was a landscape photograph and I had a branch sticking into the photograph like that, I probably would have cropped it out. But that's those two fingers right there bring the whole audience into that photograph.
Sheinbaum and all of the curators are white, and that raises some questions. Questions put to curator Brandon Fortune.
You know, I will stand back from that. As a curator, I work on paintings and contemporary art done by every kind of person in the world. So I think what I would say is come and see.
But there is the occasional disconnect. D.C.-based video artist Jefferson Pender contributed three self-portraits, which include the only music heard in the show. One video is based on Ralph Ellison's novel Invisible Man, where the protagonist lives in a basement with 1,369 light bulbs. Curator Brandon Fortune describes the progression of Pender's video, which begins with him standing under bare light bulbs, which turn on one by one.
And if you watch, slowly but surely, and he didn't use any tricks of photography, the lights become so bright that the screen becomes completely white. Sort of like heaven. It's a very powerful piece.
Were you thinking all white screen heaven?
No, I was thinking the concept of invisibility and you know, having this many. Actually, I was more fascinated with the lights.
Pender says he wants people to take the time to watch his videos in their entirety, and he wants people to have a lot of questions.
If you're taking the time, I think that you can really watch a lot of interesting layers, in particular when that white starts blowing me out and starts completely taking over who I am. The only thing that remains is this remnant of a tie, you know, this particle of a suit. I mean, every time it goes white, and when I look at that piece even now, you know, I'm kind of waiting for me to come back into it, you know. So, I mean, in that way, it's kind of touching on a lot of different issues that I think were timeless issues that Ralph Ellison is dealing with in the book.
Those issues of race, class, and identity remain at the core of hip-hop today. Allison Keys, NPR News, Washington.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. The 50th annual Grammy Awards ceremony is Sunday night in Los Angeles. Promoters of the event are making a lot of the half-century anniversary. But over the years, Grammy voters have been widely ridiculed for choices that have made them seem out of touch with popular music. The awards presenters insist those picks have gotten better, but as Joel Rose reports, the change may have come too late for an industry that's in trouble.
The Grammys started out as the music industry's answer to the Oscars. It was 1958, and rock and roll was tearing up the charts. But at clubby awards banquets in New York and Beverly Hills, Grammy voters awarded Album of the Year to Henry Mancini.
There was an outright conspiracy in those early Grammy years not to reward rock and roll.
Los Angeles Times blogger Tom O'Neill wrote a book about the Grammys. He says it would be 10 years before a rock record won Album of the Year. Writer Tom O'Neill says the Grammys did add a separate category for rock and roll in 1970.
Remember who the Grammys are. They're the industry establishment. So they're going to punish the hooligans at the door and try to keep them out.
And a lot of young fans noticed, including Sasha Frayer Jones, the pop music critic for The New Yorker magazine.
They were corny. As a kid, I just got the impression they didn't know what music was out there. And also the performance itself, the show, was just always so lame.
Now that they have finished counting, can't you feel the pressure mounting at that momentous moment? Draw a team. What an air of apprehension. You can almost taste the tension as we approach the record of the year.
The Fifth Dimension presented the Grammy for Record of the Year in 1971, the first year the awards were broadcast live on television. Simon and Garfunkel's Bridge Over Troubled Water was a reasonable choice in hindsight, but the members of the National Academy of Recording Arts and Sciences, who vote on the Grammys, have made some questionable decisions over the years, and not just the notorious Best New Artist Grammy they gave to lip syncers Milli Vanilli. The Academy has never given a Grammy to Neil Young, The Who, Led Zeppelin, or The Kinks.
Undoubtedly, there'd be oversights and there'd be lessons learned, and I think they have been.
Neil Portnow is the Recording Academy's CEO.
What we've tried to do is to make sure that we have a well-established, very broad-based, inclusive, and savvy voting population. These are peers of those that are being considered.
Those voters are peers in the sense that they work in the music industry. But there are more than 12,000 voting members who can cast ballots in a wide range of categories. That's a key difference between the Grammys and the Oscars, where directors nominate directors, screenwriters nominate screenwriters, and so on. And there are fewer Oscars up for grabs. This year, the Grammys will hand out awards in 110 separate categories, from Record of the Year to Best Hawaiian Music Album. That's made the Grammys an easy target for critics, including The Simpsons.
We had fame and fortune. Now all we needed was the approval of record company lowlives.
And the Grammy for Outstanding Soul, Spoken Word, or Barbershop Album of the Year goes to... The B-Sharps!
Yay! Recording Academy CEO Neil Portnow claims he's never seen that episode. He says despite their stumbles, the Grammys remain the most coveted award in the business.
You will always hear a musical artist who's either been nominated or received a Grammy as Grammy-nominated or Grammy-winning recording artists. And even following to the unfortunate time when there's a passing and there's an obituary, it's Grammy-winning artist so-and-so passed away today.
But that may have as much to do with journalists needing an easy way to identify an artist as it does with the Grammys themselves. Awards like the Pulitzers and the Oscars are actively coveted in their fields. But three-time Grammy Award winner Maynard James Keenan of the rock band Tool says the Grammy just doesn't have the same cachet.
It does give you a little sense of, yeah, a little pat on the back. But I don't think there's a lot of musicians out there that are catering their content to win a Grammy. It just ends up kind of happening. Unlike the Oscars, where, you know, a studio will particularly hone a film to get that Oscar.
When a movie wins the Oscar for Best Picture, it can be worth tens of millions of dollars to the studio that released it. The bounce from winning a Grammy is generally a lot smaller. Dixie Chicks saw their album Taking the Long Way jump from number 72 to number 8 on the Billboard charts the week after they swept last year's awards. But that kind of impact is rare, and it may be the last time the Grammys will have such a dramatic effect. Total album sales dropped 15% last year, continuing a slide that started 7 years ago. New Yorker critic Sasha Frere Jones says more people are getting music for free online, either through an artist's MySpace page or from unauthorized file sharing.
We're having, I think, a complete and total sort of paradigm shift. When it's really unnecessary to buy music, you know, that's something that record companies are struggling with, that there is so much legal free music available, dot, 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 you can fill in the rest.
Frere Jones says the Grammys are behind the curve once again, recognizing artists who sold a lot of CDs in 2007 while overlooking one of the most downloaded songs of the year, Crank That by Soulja Boy, who did not get nominated in the top categories.
You! Soulja Boy, tough. Hey, I got this new damn for y'all called the Soulja Boy. You gotta punch, then crank back 3 times from left to right. Soulja Boy, I'm in it. Oh, why me crank it, why me roll?
Recording Academy CEO Neil Portnow insists the Grammy Awards have survived other changes in how music reaches the consumer.
Whether it was, you know, something that was on a vinyl disc or something that was on a cassette or on an 8-track, all of these things change, but doesn't have a tremendous impact on what we do in terms of our recognition of great music every year. That really doesn't change very much for us.
But 50 years on, the music industry may be changing so much, the Grammys won't have much choice but to pay attention. For NPR News, I'm Joel Rose.
Maharishi Mahesh Yogi died on Tuesday. He was believed to be in his early 90s. Mr. Yogi died at his headquarters in the Netherlands. The Maharishi was the man who introduced transcendentalist meditation to the West. Among the best-known seekers of his wisdom were the Beatles. He was also an entrepreneur of enlightenment who built an enterprise of spiritual centers and schools that today is estimated to have assets of about $300 million. That's a lot of enlightenment. The Beatles came to visit first in 1968, and returned with some well-known friends, including Donovan, Mike Love of the Beach Boys, and Mia Farrow. But controversy broke out. The Maharishi, an avowed celibate, was accused of laying some unmeditative hands on some women who came to his ashram. John Lennon wrote the song Sexy Sadie as a thinly disguised denunciation.
Sexy Sadie, what have you done? You made a fool of everyone.
Reportedly, the song's original title was Maharishi. Those rumors of misconduct were never confirmed, and years later, George Harrison and Sir Paul McCartney denied them.
Sexy Sadie, she's the latest and the greatest of them all.
The Maharishi retired from public life just last month and said he would devote his remaining time to completing a long series of commentaries on the Veda, the sacred Hindu text.